This week's Press Gallery is brought to you by Odyssey Golf. And I got to say, guys, this is a stroke of genius. The new Stroke Lab putters from Odyssey are engineered to build a better stroke. Odyssey completely rebalanced the putter by using a multi-material shaft that moved weight towards the head and the grip. You will feel a difference immediately, and with every putt, you'll actually be building a better stroke. And a better stroke is what makes more putts. The new Stroke Lab from Odyssey, the number one putter in golf. Available in stores. Learn more about it at odysseygolf.ca. Another quick reminder to subscribe to the Press Gallery wherever you happen to podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher. Leave us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. It does help. Any questions, comments, or concerns, give me a shout. egraney@postmedia.com is my email, or I'm very easy to find hanging out on Twitter at Emma L. Graney. Thanks and enjoy this week's episode. Hello and welcome to the Press Gallery, the Edmonton Journal's politics podcast. I am your host, Provincial Affairs reporter Emma Graney. It is Friday, August 30, 2019, and this is the quarterly update that wasn't edition. With me today around the Edmonton Journal table of microphones, I've just called it that.
That sounds fun. Why not?
It does sound fun, doesn't it? Claire Clancy, my fellow legislative reporter, how are you, mate?
I'm great.
It's good.
Rainy.
It's gross out there.
I don't know. I have coffee. I'm okay.
I don't like it, man. And I had to write. I was running late, everybody, this morning. A couple of reasons. But one of them was that I couldn't find my rain pants anywhere to ride my bicycle. And last time I did that, everyone was like, it's a little sprinkle. You'll be fine. And my jeans got drenched and they stuck to my legs and I was cold and had to sit under a blanket all day.
Yeah, it's definitely worth being 5 minutes late.
It is. Keith Durian, who's just looking at me like, Emma, why is your life such a hot mess? Our politics columnist. How are you?
I'm lovely. It is quite rainy out there. I noticed the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is supposed to be having an event outside the legislature right now. It's going to be a little soggy.
Yeah, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is getting back into its media stunts way of being once again.
People should always check the weather forecast before you plan events outside.
Well, Symphony Under the Sky is on this weekend as well, and it starts tonight, so they may end up back at the Windspear Centre, but... Anyway, I know that's why you come and listen to the Press Gallery. It's not for the thoughtful analysis of Alberta politics. It's for stories about why my life is a mess and the weather. Anyway, let's move on. We've got a few things to talk about this week. As you may have picked up from the title, because you're all very intelligent, we're going to be talking about the first quarter fiscal update that we got from Finance Minister Travis Taves this week. We've got a couple of developments as well on the education file, and I will be dragging in our education reporter, Janet French, kicking and screaming probably, to talk us through seclusion rooms and also some funding uncertainty at schools. Finally, we'll have a chat about two Auditor General reports that came out this week. So, let's get started with fiscal updates. Hooray, hooray!
Yay, fiscal. Everyone's favorite topic.
Everyone loves a fiscal update, right, Keith?
Yeah, no, they're great. Yeah, no, reporters and journalists just really look forward to those fiscal updates. So.
Can I just say, this fiscal update was so odd. It was probably one of the strangest fiscal updates I've ever been to. We got two sheets of paper stapled together. They were both double-sided, but it was basically a page and a half stapled to another page and a half of text. And half of that was just about the debt under the NDP and how much it was going to be growing. There were no forecasts in there, no predictions, nothing to do with oil prices, nothing to do with what we might bring in as a province, absolutely no forecast whatsoever, which I thought was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and let's remember that the last fiscal update was very similar too, right?
Yeah.
Where it was just saying, well, you know, let's wait for the McKinnon report.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so, Keith, you covered this Q1 thing with me.
I did, yeah. Well, the last fiscal report was actually the year-end financials for 2018-19, and that was handled a little oddly because it was basically the last of the NDP's mandate, and the UCP really didn't want to touch it. They just kind of put it out with no technical expertise to guide us through it. It's just basically, boom, here it is on June 30th, and have at it, journalists.
Here you go, kids.
That's what
play
that
nice.
Went. Yeah. So for this one, they at least provided a technical briefing. They brought out the Alberta finance staff to guide us through it. Although Emma's right, there wasn't much to guide us through. And you were
there
very,
was a chart, Keith.
There was a chart. There was it had colors on it.
It had colors.
Yeah,
at least two colors on it. Yeah,
sure did.
Yeah, exactly.
Blue and orange.
Yep.
That's how you know it's serious.
Exactly. Well, and you, Emma, I give you credit because you saw this coming, because in the press release announcing that this was coming, there was a word in there and it said, you know, please join us to hear Finance Minister Travis Taves discuss the first quarter actuals.
Yep. And I was like, hang on one.
Yeah.
Hot. Second, keep trying. Get in my office. That's not normal, right? I'm not imagining things.
That's right. That's right. And so it was just the actuals, right? And so what they reported from the first quarter of the year was what they actually spent and what they actually made. And no context whatsoever to make sense of it. So there was no comparison to, hey, are we on track or off track? Are we, what does this look like if we were to extrapolate this over the year? There was not even an estimate about oil prices.
And even when we asked, and even if it wasn't in the report, we did ask these questions like, okay, well, what are you pegging oil on? They're like, you'll see that in budget. And it was like, but it's oil prices and it's Alberta, guys.
I know. No,
and they just wouldn't give us one.
They wouldn't give us anything. No projections at all about what the Alberta economy is going to do and how that might have an impact on provincial finances. So, I mean, looking at actual numbers, and the best thing they could do is kind of compare it to the same quarter from a year before. Mm-hmm. So you look at those numbers and you go, well, what does this mean? Like, what does this have to do with anything? And that's the difficulty. When you have just actual numbers, but no goals or no projections to compare it against, these numbers could just kind of exist in a vacuum.
And the numbers in a vacuum didn't look terrible.
No, and that's the thing, right? Despite the headline on the press release, which says that they showed the depth of fiscal problems in Alberta. In fact, actually, revenue was up in a couple of key areas, and resource revenue, income tax revenue.
It was exactly the same. Right. Oh, it was like $1 million or something different.
Total revenue. Yeah, that's right.
Like $1 million different from this time last year.
Although if you dive a little deeper into that, income tax revenue is up and resource revenue is up. Those are two indicators of a growing economy. Part of the reason that income generally was flat is because the carbon tax revenue has now been taken out of the mix, right? And that was a political decision by the UCP. So revenue actually is fairly is up from the quarter before.
$13.4 billion.
Yes. And expenses were also up. That's sort of the bad news because of physicians and drug costs. But that's it. That's all we can kind of tell you. And when you ask the minister about this, he says, well, we can't give you those projections. We can't give you any comparisons or put things in context for a pace. It's because, well, we still don't have a budget. And the way he phrased it was almost if like this was some sort of situation they inherited, right? As if it got lost in the mail or eaten by Rachel Notley's dog, right? And when in fact, the fact they don't have a budget is because they chose not to introduce one in the spring session. They wanted to wait till the McKinnon report was out and then introduce a budget in the fall. That's the reason. So it came across a little rich for me for the minister to basically say, no, we can't give you any projections. That's a choice that they've made. It's not an inevitability.
And these fiscal updates serve a purpose. I think it's frustrating as journalists, and I'm sure to the public, that what's going to happen is we're going to see a budget in the fall shortly before the federal election, having not had any real fiscal update for months on the state of the province. Mm. And you have to ask, how fair is that to the public, actually, who are going to potentially be voting for candidates that the provincial parties are also supporting?
Right. And we also know that they have projections, right? Alberta Finance would be dumb not to have projections.
You can't tell me there's nothing sitting in a folder on Mr. Forrest's files. James Forrest is one of the kind of deputy ministers or bureaucrats who helps us through explain all this stuff to us on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You can't tell me he does not have a ring binder somewhere in his office.
Yeah.
With has oil models. Prices and projections and models. And
exactly.
Such.
If we are on pace, this was, you know, what would we be on? Right. And so if you look at it, Alberta in the first quarter posted an $835 million deficit just in that quarter. If you project that over the year, all things being equal, that comes into about a $3.3 billion deficit, which would be half of what it was the year before. And the NDP would look at this and go, hey, see, our plan was working. We were gradually reducing the deficit. We were on a path to balance. The government right now, though, doesn't want to make those extrapolations. And their explanation for that is, well, there's just too many factors. There's too many variables to consider. At this point, it would be useless to give you any kind of projections. However, they broke their rule in one occasion. So it makes me question their logic on this. And that was the graph you referred to. They put a graph in there showing the projected provincial debt out to 23-24, especially under the NDP plan, right? And it showed the march of provincial debt up to about $100 billion by that point. So they have some projections. That one they allowed in the document.
And when I asked why it was that they're including that and saying that there were no other projections that they could possibly give us, the explanation was, oh, well, that's public and already out there and was part of the NDP's plan and was already in budget documents. So, you know, we right. just, that's fair enough to yeah. throw that one in there. That was the official's explanation.
Yeah, I have to question that again. And they also monkeyed
Keith,
with that.
Keith, you're so questioning things well, today, man.
Well, they also monkeyed with that figure, so it hasn't been entirely public. They added in $5 billion to the debt load, right, because of a reserve fund that had previously been excluded. So the handy thing about that is it moved the NDP's debt from $95 billion to a nice round $100 billion, which is the figure I think you're going to see Jason Kenney swing at Rachel Notley quite often in the next 4 years. So that, to me, smelled a little off.
We saw that in the annual report as well, where the only statement that we got from the finance minister on that report was related to this $100 billion debt number. And the first question we had was, where's that number coming from? What's included in it? And this is, I mean, it just is a super frustrating exercise to have to question every single number that you're being given.
I mean, we do
but
that.
But we do that anyway.
Anyway. It was a strange little update to write about, basically. I mean, the overall vibe and the repeated message in the press release and from Travis Tapes, the finance minister, as well, was, you know what? Cuts are coming. Fiscal restraint is coming. Belt tightening is going to be happening for sure. And yet, revenues are flat. Expenses have actually dropped as well.
Yeah, total expenses have dropped. However, operating expenses are up.
Went up, yes.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
It's just, it was all very weird. I'm not going to lie.
It was interesting in that sense, right? So in terms of quarterly updates, which journalists just love most of the time, this one was probably a little more interesting than we've seen. But what is going on here, and this is part of a pattern we've seen from this government, is that they are laying the groundwork, as you said, for a very tough budget to come in this fall. We're probably going to see the McKinnon report very shortly. That is also going to lay the groundwork for a very tough budget. And so the UCP is trying to create this impression that we are in a very bad, a worsening financial crisis, right? This has been the message basically since Jason Kenney took office. The books are in worse shape than the NDP let on, right? He said that a number of times. Haven't really seen the proof of that, but that is the message. And so, yeah, you don't want to release a fiscal update with numbers that show maybe the crisis isn't quite as bad as we've been letting on, right? And that's where I think why we didn't see a lot of projections here, that maybe the situation isn't quite as dire as the UCP wants to admit at this point. And so they're hiding those numbers from us and instead trying to convince us through a kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, hey, trust us, the situation's actually quite awful. The problem is for me, I don't think they need to do this. I think this is all unnecessary. I think the situation as it is probably bad enough. I think most Albertans can get behind the idea that whether it's $95 billion in debt or $100 billion in debt, that's probably not a good thing. Mm-hmm. We need to stop that. Deficits need to be stopped. And yeah, we might have a bit of a spending problem here. I think we also have a revenue problem. But, you know, I think the main message the UCP wants to get across, they don't need to dress it up like this. They don't need to be all mysterious about it. I think the facts and figures are there on their own to support what they want to do.
They do speak for themselves. I with the lack of projections, I asked officials, hey, like, when was the last time that you guys gave a quarterly update that contained zero projections? Apparently it was under Finance Minister Doug Horner.
Yes, I remember this.
And apparently it caused much upset.
It did.
And that is why they stopped doing it. He tried it once and it didn't work out so well.
Well, even the Auditor General came down on him and said, no, stop that. That's just dumb.
Because didn't he use similar and this is before my time, but didn't he use kind of similar reasoning to the UCP that, well, you know, it's all, who knows how much we're going to bring in?
It was a little bit of that. It was more like their excuse was, well, if we show you the projections, you're just going to focus on that, silly media.
That's what it was.
Exactly, right? When in fact, you know, we don't exactly know what it's going to end up. And so it's just kind of dumb to give you that right now. Let's focus on the actuals, what actually happened in this last quarter. That's the message we want to get across. Not that large deficit that might be coming down the pipe.
Nothing to see here, friends.
Exactly, right. And so, yeah, the media quite rightly said, no, we've been doing it the other way for years, decades. Let's just stick with that. And the Auditor General agreed.
Just on Keith's point, I wanted to also remind people that I think you were the one at a news conference with the Premier recently where you asked him directly, where is the evidence for this dire situation that that the NDP have left Alberta in? And his response was, it'll be in the McKinnon report. So,
right. We'll see. We'll see if it's in there. It wasn't in this quarterly update, though. I can tell you that. Right. It wasn't in the last quarterly update. So I'm still curious where this is coming from.
Okay, let's move on to our next segment. No, it's not. Let's move on to our next topic. And I've brought in Janet French, our education reporter. Say hi to all the kids at home, Janet.
Hello, all the kids at home.
Thanks for coming in.
They're in a seclusion room. They can't hear you.
Oh.
I mean, good segue, because that's what we're going to be talking about.
Sure is.
Seclusion rooms. And as well as seclusion rooms, which I apparently can't say this morning, we're going to be talking a little bit about some funding uncertainty, which has been an ongoing challenge for a lot of school boards. But let's start off with the seclusion room file, Janet, because this has been a whole thing. I feel like it's a real seesaw, this issue, right? It's like, ban them. Don't ban them. We kind of need them. No, we kind of don't need them. They're terrible. We've banned them. We're unbanning them. Talk us through, Janet. What the heck is going on here?
Okay, this is where we cue the like doo-doo-doo-doo, like back in the day music. So unbeknownst to most of us, in 2017, some parents from Sherwood Park filed a lawsuit against the Elk Island School Board and also the government and some other workers at a school. They claim that their son, who was 12 at the time and has autism, was put in a seclusion room in a Sherwood Park school, that he was in there naked for at least 45 minutes. And when they found him, he was covered in his own feces. And they also claim that the staff were not adequately watching him while this was all going on. Now, of course, the usual caveat we have to say here is that none of these allegations have been proven in court and that the school district disputes that they have done anything wrong in this case. It's still making its way through court. Anyhow, about a year later, this is the case that Inclusion Alberta used as an example of why these seclusion rooms are a terrible idea. Inclusion Alberta is an organization that advocates for people who have disabilities and their families. So they said that from the anecdotes they'd been hearing from people, mm-hmm. that seclusion rooms were being misused, that they weren't just a blank room where schools would use in a total emergency where someone was having a freak out and just needed a brief place to collect themselves where they wouldn't hurt anybody. They said that they had been hearing stories from parents who said their kids were repeatedly put in these rooms when staff didn't feel equipped to handle any sort of behavioral outbursts. And so they launched a survey last year to ask parents, hey, how often are these rooms being used? Where are they being used? What sort of effect is it having on the kids? They wanted some data because there is no data. And in the interim, we turned to the education minister at the time, which was NDP education minister David Egan. And he said, oh, well, actually, I've already struck a panel to have a look at this issue to try and figure out, you know, whether the guidelines we have now are applicable or current and whether we should revise them. And so that panel started their work in late 2018. And they did come up with something which was never formally released. And then around about the springtime in 2019, different groups started making rumblings about these recommendations, saying they didn't go far enough. And then all of a sudden, Egan came out and said in March of 2019, we are banning seclusion rooms in mm-hmm. schools. School divisions can apply for an exemption if they think they really need them. But generally, there's a ban. We'd think that they're not appropriate based on the stories we've heard. He took some heat at the time because some people said that the ban should have been immediate. He gave a transition period. It was going to come into effect on September 1st. Then there was an election. And here we are. And so the UCP took office. And so I've been asking them, one of the things I've been asking them since they took office is, so this ban, is it going ahead? And, you know, TikTok, like September 1st is now 2 days away. So what happened last week was that the Edmonton Public School Board, the Calgary Board of Education, and the Catholic school boards in both Edmonton and Calgary all came out together and said, we really are uncomfortable with this ban. We would like the option to use seclusion rooms. And we feel like there's a lack of clarity, because if there's a ban, then what tools do we have at our disposal,
right,
when we have, you know, children who have behavioral outbursts, who are a risk to themselves, a risk to other people, a risk to staff. And we've also heard from the Alberta Teachers Association that staff are injured at school sometimes when they're dealing with students who can be violent.
Yeah, my mum, actually, she was a grade one teacher for like 40 years, or grade one to three teacher, I suppose. And once she had a grade three student, and he had some really serious learning and mental development issues. And he would call her Mushroom to start with because of her haircut at the time. And then he would just hit her and punch her. And she would come home with bruises. He nearly like broke her wrist once, like just grabbing her and kind of throwing her across the room. And she was dealing with him and then a whole entire classroom of 28 other kids in grade three. Wow. And they only had an educational assistant like 2 days a week. Not that she would have necessarily used a seclusion room, but it's like those kind of really stark examples of teachers being physically injured by students.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question and a difficult one for school boards, because they've got a balance.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they've received some legal opinions that I've tried to ask about. But like, how do you protect the safety of your employees, not just teachers, but also, you know, educational assistants, other school staff, and therapists and so forth, and also balance the human rights of children to not be locked into solitary confinement, right? And so the question is, like, are these rooms being used appropriately, and who was watching? Was anybody? No, really, nobody was. Nobody's watching. Nobody was monitoring. There's no data on how many rooms there are. There's no data on how often they were used, how often certain kids were put in those rooms. And so what happened yesterday, but technically on paper happened on Wednesday, was that Education Minister Adriana LaGrange scrapped the ministerial order that Egan used to ban seclusion rooms. So, sorry, that was too many negatives. Seclusion rooms, ban,
and now unbanned.
Gone. And brought in a new ministerial order and said, okay, listen, here are a set of interim standards for using seclusion room. And the word standard is important, because one of the things that advocates were asking for is requirements that are binding. So before, there were guidelines in Alberta. Oh, if you have a seclusion room, you should do this and you should do that. But there were no requirements. There was no one checking to make sure they were being used properly. So she's saying these are binding. Number two, she's saying, okay, a bunch of various parties, including Alberta Teachers Association and Inclusion Alberta and school boards and others, will come together and come up with a more permanent set of binding standards. And also a really important note is that school boards now have to track at the school level how often they're using the rooms, who's in the rooms, how much time they're spending in there. And so that is something that disability advocates are saying, that's great. We really want that data, and we hope that data is made public.
Mm-hmm. So basically now they can still use them, but they've got some standards that they have to use, and they have to actually record when they're being used, which was never before, which is actually really valuable data to have. I mean, just having a room that you throw kids into, and then, little Bobby was in there for 5 hours. I don't know. Keith, what's your read on this, mate?
Yeah, well, this is one area I probably don't have a ton of expertise in. I don't think I've been in a classroom except for political events in probably 20 years. So I'm sort of going by memory here. And I think Janet laid it out there. It's like, if you don't have a seclusion room, what's the alternative, right? And I think back to my own school days, some classmates that had moments where they really wigged out and the teacher had to take them away out of the class. Where did they go? Did they go to the principal's office and sit with the staff? Did they go to the nursing station? I'm sure the nurses loved that at the time. So, you know, I do feel sort of for a teacher, if they don't have this option available, they've got this kid who is obviously having some issues, can't be around other kids at that point. You've also got like 33-ish other kids that you got to worry about at the same time. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with this one child who's not having a good day? I don't think necessarily a ban was well thought out at this point.
Seemed kind of reactionary.
Yeah, but I do agree that I think we need to study these further, make sure that they are used appropriately, and actually have some measure what this does to the kids, because there may be kids where this is not an appropriate This is not an appropriate thing. So I do actually think the government might be doing the right thing here. And at least if listening to the school boards, that hasn't always been the case at governments, listening to school boards. In this case, if the boards are saying, we think a ban is probably not the way to go at this point, well, kudos to the government for listening to that.
I want to move over to another thing in education that's been kind of bubbling its way around for quite some time, and that's uncertainty around the budget. Now, of course, the budget is coming in the fall. I had a story this week about how a support worker, a success coach it was called, basically served three schools, was cut because of budget uncertainty. That's basically what it boils down to. Now, as far as I understand from speaking with the Edmonton Public School Board Chair, Trisha Esther Brooks. Sorry, Trisha. This has kind of been an ongoing thing for most schools. And Janet, I know you did another story at Horse Hill School, right? They're in a similar situation.
Yeah, they had a mental health therapist who worked at, I believe she was split between Horse Hill School and other schools. And some of those positions were fairly new, where that school board in particular is paying, one of their like main priorities right now is improving child mental health. You know, they have one trustee who is particularly interested in that issue and has been really pushing it. And they just know, they're hearing from staff how much of an effect it has. You know, how are you, just like if you haven't eaten anything that day or you don't have anywhere stable to live, if you've got poor mental health, then you're not going to be performing very well on your math PATs, are you? So school boards are sort of increasingly on the front lines of filling in the gaps in the health system and the social services system. Mm-hmm. And so that is why we're seeing workers hired like mental health therapists and other support workers that may not be traditional, just like teachers, here's the curriculum. And so unfortunately, I think that's probably one of the first things to go, because technically that is not in their mandate. Like nobody, there's no law that says school districts have to provide these ancillary or additional services to students. So another difficulty about getting information about this is that Edmonton is actually known internationally, I'll have you know, as being a champion of something called site-based decision making, which is great for individual school control over how they spend their money, but really makes it difficult from a reporter's perspective to get district-wide information about trends. And so it means that individual principals are now in the position of saying, okay, here's how much money I've been allotted for the coming year. I'm making difficult decisions because maybe I have, it may not be less money, but they may know that they're going to have 100 more students. Yep. So then how do they allocate that money based on what on paper it says that they're required to do?
Yeah. You're going to get three more teachers, or you're going to get a couple of success coaches or a mental health therapist or something
so,
like that.
So, I mean, it's, I guess they're playing an unpleasant, they're in a dilemma. They're making unpleasant trade-offs.
Right? And I mean, Esterbrook said to me, well, maybe when the full budget comes, it won't be as bad. The Classroom Improvement Fund, which the Edmonton Public Board has just assumed is not going to happen.
Yeah, most boards have assumed that that's a goner.
Yeah, so they're just assuming this money won't be there. So that's why these principals are having to make these tough choices. But she's like, you know what? Maybe we'll be in a really good position in the fall and we can turn around to these principals and say, hooray, you do have more money than you thought. Hire back that mental health therapist. Janet, thank you so much for jumping in, mate. Appreciate
My
it. You
pleasure.
May now leave the building, or the studio at least.
I can leave the building?
No, I am not your boss. I cannot tell you. You may have Friday off, Janet. Thanks, mate.
Okay, bye.
And finally, we're going to move over to auditor reports that came out this week. Everyone loves an auditor report, especially a journalist. I love them anyway, because I'm a nerd.
Quarterly updates and auditor's reports.
Oh,
this
so
is
riveting.
A humdinger of an episode.
It really is.
Yeah, right?
One for the history books.
So welcome, listeners. Clancy, you covered this. What happened, mate?
I did. So just two auditor reports were released yesterday. One was related to performance measures for the finance ministry. And it was basically the auditor remade recommendations that have been made before. So that one
2012 and 2014.
Right.
And still not doing it.
And Minister Taves did say he was going to look at those recommendations and adopt them. But the other report formed the main part of my story, which was about appointments to boards, agencies, and commissions. And if you
Which you might remember from last week's adventures.
Yeah, exactly. Last week, we saw the UCP appoint new board members on almost 20 boards. So that was a huge, kind of a huge dump of information. We talked about it last week on the podcast. The Auditor General report basically said that the government needs to streamline its process for appointing these public positions, and had a slew of recommendations related to that. Finance Minister Taves released a statement on that as well and said that they're looking at the recommendations and taking them seriously. And he kind of attributed the issues to appointments to the NDP, which, you know, isn't a surprise. A lot of the appointments that were looked at, all of the appointments that were looked at, I guess, in the report were done under the NDP, I should say. So it's somewhat unrelated to last week's huge slew of appointments.
Just a really timely...
So this is, isn't this so riveting? Me talking about appointments, boards, agencies, commissions, all the best buzzwords everyone loves.
But it is timely because of what happened last week.
Yes,
or the week before last, last Friday,
sometime,
2 weeks
sometime
ago.
Recently.
Sometime in the recent past. It was Friday, 2 weeks
but
ago.
But that's a quick summary of two AG reports. And
well done, Clancy.
Yeah, thank you.
Keith? Yeah, and I know these won't get a lot of attention, but I do actually think both of those reports are quite important. They're issues that kind of fly under the radar, but yeah, appointments to boards, agencies, and commissions is important, and we did hear some issues that the NDP had with those. I mean, the disappointing part, at least in that audit, was that there doesn't seem to be any kind of recommendations or movement around how do you prevent political appointments, or at least an excessive amount of political appointments. That's the, I think, an issue there. I don't know what an auditor could say to say, well, even if a person's qualified, you should probably pick people from different partisan persuasions rather than just one. I think that's probably common sense. Maybe it doesn't need to be in an auditor's report, but still, it would be nice to see that addressed because that does seem to be an ongoing problem. The other audit, having to do with the annual reports, this is an issue I've actually been concerned about for quite some time. My memory, and maybe it's a little jaded at this point, but my memory is of audit reports, or annual reports, ministry annual reports in the past, was that they were kind of an honest reflection of what a ministry accomplished, right? They had their goals at the start of the year. They had their budget at the start of the year. Well, where did you actually come in? Did you achieve your goals? Did you meet your budget or not? And then if you didn't, what's the explanation? And in recent years, I think those annual reports have become much more political documents. It's basically more an ability for the ministry to say, hey, look how great we are. And there's not as much of an honest discussion about areas where they screwed up. And those things are given a lot, pretty much short shrift in there, or not mentioned at all in some cases. And I really do think they believe that the public is not watching. And this is where an auditor has to step in and say, no, wait, guys, this is actually important. This is the one opportunity that the public has to see an honest accounting of how you perform during a year. And to my mind, they haven't been doing it very well.
Okay, let's move over to our regular segment, Good Stuff from the Gallery, in which we recommend things we've read or seen or listened to lately that we think you might also enjoy. Clancy, kick us off, mate.
Sure. I'm going to recommend a really interesting long read that I liked a lot yesterday. And it's called, I don't think I've ever recommended something from Elle magazine before.
Wow.
But it's very good. It's called Two Sisters and the Terrorist Who Came Between Them. And it's this really, really bizarre story about these two girls who grew up in Springdale, Arkansas. And basically one of them falls in love with someone who ends up bringing her and her family to Syria to fight with ISIS and the fallout from that. It's just a really fascinating read about these family dynamics and just a very crazy, crazy story.
Whoa. I'm actually going to recommend a podcast. Look, we're switching roles, Clancy, this week. This is something that my buddies Kelly and Sam recommended on a Facebook post. And I'm headed to Africa actually next week. So I'm going to file away the last few episodes. I've only listened to the first little bit, but I'm enjoying it immensely so far. It's called Moonrise, and it's a podcast from the Washington Post, and it's a really awesome kind of dive into the space race and why the US went to the moon, how that happened, and it's just like, it's really, really well done, and I'm looking forward to listening to the rest of it. Keith, what you got for us?
Yeah, I also have a long read. This one's called When Your Social Worker Thinks You're Ungrateful. And it is actually written by a social worker. And it's just a kind of a fascinating insight into the life of a social worker. And it's a particular case that this woman had with this Iranian family. It's set in England. And it's just, you know, there might be this assumption that these immigrant families, the people who need social workers, caseworkers, would be grateful to have this help. And a lot of times they're just not. They consider you an annoyance and they want you to go away and just leave them alone. And so it is kind of an interesting view on the inside as to what these social workers go through at times.
Interesting. Guys, thank you so much for joining me for another week of analysis and fun and games about Alberta politics. Claire Clancy, Keith Durine, and our education reporter, Janet French. We will be back again this time next week. We'll probably be taking a short break after that. But as always, thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, hit me up. egraney@postmedia.com is my email, or I'm on Twitter @EmmaLGraney. Thanks for listening.